Could you hear it? And now, it's time for a live show here on Scenesat Radio.
Yes, Sifuan here. Datastorm is back. I hope. summer again. I'm trying to get stuff started here, which is horribly horrible. Except another try. There we go. And hopefully I'll be going live on the Scenesat Facebook page as well. And I don't know if I'm live on the Sofa Sceners page. if I'm live on the scene. No, it says it's offline. Facebook does not want to play nice today. Okay. I don't know if it's working or not. Please let me know if you see this somewhere. Because I'm not... It's trouble to actually debug stuff when sitting in the core of the action. this is Sifoid anyway. Very distracted, as usual. Hopefully I'm getting stuff live now. Okay. Can someone type me? Okay, it's fine on Facebook on the scenesat.com site. Okay, I'm not going to touch anything bad then. I'll stop the Sofa Sceners Facebook because that just messes stuff up a bit. I'll fipple that onto the Scenesat page instead. Scooby-doop-dop-doop. Okay. Share. Can I copy that link? Sharing a group. Sofa Sceners. Check this one out instead. There we go. Okay, hi. This is a very distracted Sifoid from Datastorm in Gothenburg. We're about to experience the Cracker Panel, and that will be a group of crackers, old school, from the Amiga days and Commodore 64 days, and they'll be discussing some stuff. I don't know if it's going to be in Swedish or English, but it should be. Some interesting things. The people I see now is the Baron... Carl the 12th, Bacchus, and Conqueror, and there might be some additional one as well. But they have they've done some major cracking throughout the years, so hopefully it should be working the way it is. I get a question from Jewel: which stream is the best? Well, the source is the scenesat.com/video. That should be the best one. Twitch re-encodes the audio a bit, so I'm not sure that it's that best. Facebook makes everything mono, so they tweak that into a mono feed, which is a bit annoying. And YouTube actually transparently moves over. So if you're low on bandwidth, you can use YouTube and their transcoding functionality, so you can have a lower quality stream if you need it. It's a 4 megabit stream, so it can be a bit troublesome for some people to watch. Best experience should be the low latency player on scenesat.com/video. That will give you the lowest possible latency, a couple of seconds from when it's happening here. You'll actually see it. And that should be the best one, I guess. And yes, as said, and right now I'm just waiting for people to get started. And we'll see if we can focus the camera a bit more, because it looks a bit blurry, but hopefully you'll see what's happening anyway. You'll hear what they're talking about, which is the primary thing here. But It's always interesting to do broadcasting from these kind of events, especially since you're on a very ad hoc setup when it comes to uplink and connections and everything like that. So it's good fun, but you can actually get extra gray and white hairs in your beard and hair after this, I can tell you. Well, that's the beauty of live broadcasting, I guess. Throughout the day, there will be more things happening. We have, let me see, there we have the Datastorm schedule. This panel should be going for, I guess, half an hour or something like that. Sadly, I won't be able to broadcast DJ Optirock because he's outdoors and we don't have a connection there. And then dinner and the Voodoo Lady. I don't know if I'm going to broadcast that. I might just put on the video stream and see what happens there. I won't be able to broadcast Smog Tom 80 because that's also going to be outdoors. But at 8 p.m., Chris Ulsbeck will be interviewed by Mahoney on stage, so that shall be broadcast. And it's going to be an interesting talk, I'm pretty sure. And from 9 p.m. and onwards, that is in about 5.5 hours, the rest of the compos will commence. So look forward to that. I'm just going to play a track for now. This is Visa Röster, powered by Larsek Rambo, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Lazaruster with the beautiful voice of Hannah Kapalin and music powered by Larsek. Rambo Loader, original by Martin Galway. Right now we're waiting for the Cracker panel to start. Just trying to get some time passing by here. We have Orbiter around there. He might open a beer. Oh, we'll see. I think it's time to start. I think Spot is waiting for something, so it might start now. That's going to be interesting. The Cracker panel. Here we go.
Data storm. Yes. Conqueror has gathered the biggest mouths at Data Storm for a little panel debate about cracking and the things surrounding it. So, Conqueror.
Hello. Now it's on. So, welcome to the Cracker panel here at Data Storm 2017. So we have gathered a distinguished panel of guests, and I would like you to sort of quickly introduce yourself and say your handle, groups you were active in, during which period, what platforms you were active on, and sort of what roles or functions you took.
Hello, I'm called Bob of Sensor Design. We were active as a cracking group as well back in 89, 88, even earlier, but the sensor definitely 89, and on forth to 94, 5, ending with the console era. And what was more the question? Yeah, not basically that. Anyway, so we have some stories about that, but that will be shared during this period.
I'm Hedning from Genesis Project. Thank you, Papa Demos. I have a personal fan club presented here from my own group. I'm the main organizer for Genesis Project, and we are active now in the cracking scene since I have been active since 2009, and we revived the C64 cracking scene a bit. There is two different views on cracking today. The preserve, when you preserve old games that has never been found, and of course finding new games to crack these days.
I'm Bacchus from Fairlight. I tend to say I'm sort of a noob in this business because I joined Fairlight only in 88, whereas the group was founded in 87. So again, thanks for inviting also the noobs to the place. Fairlight is built as sections, and there is a triad in the top. So we are three guys in the council, Strider, myself, and JBM. And my responsibility has always been the C64 section, since Strider handed it over to me in 89 or thereabout. So I've been the leader for the C64 section and also sort of the main cracker throughout most of the period. And I did actually code one or two demo parts in the late 80s. I wouldn't be able to do it today.
Hello, I'm K12, and I was mostly involved with the cracking scene in groups such as Science 451, Agile, and Sphinx, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
I am the Baron from the group Defium. I was running the European headquarters for BBS, West BBS. My work was mostly to document things and administrate things, and also made some hacking, but not for Defium, for my own good. So I have some things to tell you a little bit later about that.
All right, thank you. Maybe I should say something about myself as well. I'm Conqueror. I was not very active on the Commodore 64, even though I did have one and I did code a little bit on it, but I was mostly active on the Amiga, where I did crack quite a lot in groups such as Horizon, Def Jam, Fairlight, Agile, Cortex, Paradox, and others.
You've been in all
groups. Not all of them, but a couple of them, yeah. Anyway, so... So let's get this started. We're trying to sort of get grasps on what cracking is, and not is necessarily technical details, but more sort of the bigger picture. Why do we do it? Why does cracking exist? What motivates crackers and cracker groups, and so on? So do you have any take on it? Anyone?
I can talk for the cracking scene of today. Today it's, as I mentioned before, divided into two, in my view, two different views of looking at it. One is to preserve games that has never been found before and bring them forth to everybody to enjoy. It can be on the C64, old obscure games only released in... on small brands and stuff like that. And we also have the first release race of four new games. As you might know, the C64 scene and the game scene, developing scene, is pretty big today. I think there are about 20 games released every year commercially. And there is still a very active cracking scene fighting for points in magazines, and even that is part of preservation. We preserve the tradition of the old days, kind of.
So would you say the preservation track, it's about cultural heritage, sort of like museums, or like from that point of view, is that why you do it?
Today is it's very much fun also. I mean, it's not just a museum, it's alive, and yeah. And today, there is a big point in preserving the ideas from, just like we do demos on the C64 today, we keep on the traditions from back in the days today. And it's fun to do that too. Genesis Produce is doing both demos and cracks today to honor the past and to bring it forth to the future also.
So, Bacchus, what motivated you and Fairlight in the early days?
Well, for me, it was always about the ego. I wanted to be seen, I wanted to be on the stage, and I want to be the center of attention. A very humble, yes. But how do you do that? And I had a certain skill for looking at other people's code and reading other people's code and fiddling with other people's code, so... I could, the puzzle solving part of it facilitated my ego. So it's a good combination of two things that I found really interesting. And so I would say that's my main driver. And I guess to this day, the public appreciation of what you do is still a valid point. I mean, a number of artists would paint even if they put their art in the closet. A number of artists only strive for the public appreciation of what they do. So, and I strive for the public appreciation, which makes it very difficult for me to understand today's scene where it says supplied by Fairlight, cracked by Fairlight, and distributed by Fairlight. Yeah, who did that? Whose ego was not boosted by this release?
Yeah, then you talk about personal motivation, which of course can be a strong driver.
Yeah.
But if we look at sort of the broader picture, I mean, why did cracking even evolve? I mean, then I mean as a scene, as a cultural phenomenon, rather than just sort of the personal view. And what happened and what motivated that?
Well, it builds on the individual. If there is nobody who has the individual driver, there would be no bigger picture.
Yeah, I agree. But is there things that that exist that goes beyond the individual motivation in parts of sort of establishing the scene and the subculture and so on?
I would say no. I mean, sometimes the scene is seen like a mafia thing. If you read the news about it, it's seen like this subculture that is basically, where the analogies for drug dealing, they are apparent. So there was somebody from the UK that interviewed me, and when I read his thesis afterward, it was like doing comparison between what we did and pushing drugs, which was really strange. There is also kind of the perception that the scene is a, like the mafia. You become a member. You basically apply for membership. And for me, the scene is the stage. The scene is existing in other areas as well. You can talk about the hard rock scene in the UK. That's also the scene. So we are that scene, and we're built by individuals, and the sum of what every individual is doing is what forms the scene. And there is no bigger consensus on the scene. That's a sum of 1 million different small individuals doing contributions.
Yeah, Bob has a comment.
I have a different point of view on this, actually. you can always see it as groups, as a sporting team. Like Manchester United, a sense of design. It's a race to the top. Who will win? Who will beat the other ones?
Are you it's Huddersfield United or something? No, we are Manchester United.
No, we are sensor design. It's above all. I felt it more of a race rather than... of course, you had your family, your closest friends, as you mentioned, like teams, underground teams, etc., etc. But no, it's a sporting thing, in my opinion. And it still is today with the demo competition. Your main objective is to beat the other ones, period.
Yeah, and I mean, in contrast to, say, a mafia or a sort of organized crime groups or anything, this is about meritocracy. It's the merits. I mean, it's your technical skills and your aesthetic skills and everything together. It's your skills that count, not your connections primarily.
And in the end, this was also ranked on the ranking list. And to be on the top of the ranking list, yes, I could refer that as an absolute ego boost, and it is probably still of today, and one of the main motivators. And yes, it is true, as Bacchus says also, it's for the spectators. The more they appreciate, the more it drives us to continue and contribute. I mean, there is nothing more demotivating if you do a total flop.
Of course.
That could really stop the whatever it is you want to continue
so
with.
Would you agree with people who say that there are sort of a more general ethical values generally of hackers, like the idea of information wants to be free and so on, that established in the 1970s at MIT, for instance? I mean, has that influenced you, or would you say that is not present? It was not present, or it's not present in the scene?
It's a good question, because I think actually when the information got free by cracking, it made it possible to reach everyone, and the interest from everyone grow exponentially. And that made computer interest so much more enhanced than it perhaps would have been if everybody had to buy the expensive stuff. I think the evolution grew much faster. It evolved much faster than it otherwise should have.
So it's more a consequence rather than sort of a conscious stance or anything like that?
Yes, I mean, there is two aspects of it. Information wants to be free, the competitive things, and of course, the evolution. And I think these three goes to get hand in hand. It's not just one of them.
All right, maybe we should move on a bit to understand more of sort of the handiwork and the practical stuff in cracking games. Perhaps not so much the technical details. We discussed it a bit yesterday, Bacchus and I. But I mean, the things around that, organizing things. Getting games costs money. How do you get around that? Do you actually have money to buy all the games and then crack them and then release them? How did the supply chain management work in getting your hand on originals, especially in competition with others?
Oh, you have to be a very talkative person. Go to every store, smooth talk every salespeople, show them demos, show them something that catch their absolute interest, become friends with them, take a beer with them. In the end, they will shuffle you with originals over the board. And you will get the pre-hand information, previews, whatever. And that is the sort of things I did back then.
Any other comments?
I agree. It's the same.
Yeah, I seldom bought games, but the games I actually bought, I tried to crack the fastest. But I had the supply chain from the UK, where I got new games, express delivery on the mail. And when I got home, I immediately went to the mailbox and checked the mail. And if there was an original game in there, I was trying to crack it really fast, but because I knew that I was one of the first in Sweden to have it. So that was a factor that drove me to actually try to crack the game, because I knew I could be first with doing that.
Our original founding fathers were from Diskette, a shop down in Malmö. So started to work there, and a number of other members worked in that shop. So that was, they borrowed home the new one and then handed it back the next day. And I guess everybody has heard about the story when Last Ninja was released, and Strider got it and bribed a guy working on a train with a few bars of chocolate, sending it to Gollum in Ronneby, where Gollum picked it up on the train station, cracked it, and then sent it back when it was done. So Diskette was our original first one, but then it became more difficult to be competitive when you had the Swedish stores. And I agree, UK was the strong one. So having somebody working on Virgin Megastore in London was sort of the key objective. So if you worked at Virgin Megastore in London, you were approached constantly by a number of groups wanting your stuff.
Well, I'm not a cracker, but I'm a hacker. I don't crack things. Sometimes I've done that, but why are we doing it? It's like a mountain climber. We do it because we can. We want to go to the top. We can. Who said that? Yes, we can. Well, I have another approach about hacking security. The biggest problem I've seen are the administrators in companies. You can't trust them because they have root access to everything and can do everything they want. They can sell information under the table. And about the security for all companies, even game makers, we have something called social engineering, candy bars, everything. So the biggest problem are the administrators, the admins. The next problem is the cloud. Not long ago, we were sending files through the cloud, and they crypted it when they reached the destination. You have to crypt it before it leaves your computer. That's the next problem. Next problem is the redundancy of systems. Many companies don't have any redundancy. They have bad backups. They need at least three backups from three different geographic locations. We don't do that today because it's too expensive. I told a company a couple of years ago, why don't you have three backups?
Maybe we can get back to cracking.
Hacking.
No, cracking
things. Yeah. Social engineering.
Yeah, social engineering is definitely an important part. That we saw that many people approached, had different ways of social engineering in order to get hold of original. So I definitely agree it's one important skill. But trying to understand sort of the broader picture, once you got the originals, then, I mean, how much time did it typically take to go from getting your hands on the original till you had the crack done and sort of trained and you put your intro on it, linked it? I mean, everything was done already. Was that a matter of half an hour, days? And how did that fit into your everyday routines in those days? I mean, most of you were in school, like I would guess, and you had other things to take care of. So, I mean, how did it work out?
Once after I was a trip among the shops and gathered the copies, I used to take the subway to CRT, who lived quite near the city, and hand him over the originals. CRT was already prepped, all the tools were set up. He was one hell of a cracker, extremely fast. I mean, from my hand, it could take anything between 4 hours, if it's on an easier crack, up to maximum 2 days. I never seen him spend more than 2 days on a crack. And then he probably was doing other stuff during the day as well. So, and sometimes when I had a lot of originals, I had to go to Södertälje, where we live in Stockholm then, and where we had a Psycho, another masterful cracker, and he used to crack, and him and CRT, if they had like 4 or 5 games at the same time to crack, then they used to go to one another and sit down a whole weekend and basically crack them all. So it was very quick, and we used to be the first ones up on the US boards. We had several boards back then in the US, and to get the first releases and stuff like that. So that was a yes, and we went to school. So we had no other things, duties, or must-dos by then.
Yeah. Any other take on that? Marcus?
Yeah, well, I mean, how long it takes is basically the factor of how skillful are you and what tools do you have available. So, again, as Patrick talked about before, the transfer routines, if you cracked a tape loader once, you would only need to do it once, because then you would have concluded your work by making a transfer. So the next time, you don't have to go through the entire cracking process, because everything is mapped up and you have it mapped out and you have a tool. So you just push it to the disk and then you work from it from there. So the cracking is done automatically from you by a tool you already developed. And by the way, I started out using your Cyberload transfer. I used that for ages. It's a brilliant one. If anybody would like the password for his tools, let me know. It's ploy alpha, I think it is. Yeah, it's. I think Synchro did a few that were really good as well. So again, so first time it took a long time, but doing it again, if that took a long time, then you're an idiot. So preparing, documenting, keeping it, so next time you got around, you had a head start.
I mean, the first time you received a new copy protection of a cassette tape, you try to actually crack it, the really hard thing. But if you had time over, you would write the transfer program for it. So if you encountered it the next time, it was just about using that program, and then it was done. However, the cracking process was much longer than that, because in the 1986, 1987, it was like spending 2 or 3 hours just crunching the program to make it small. So there was a competition about making the cracks small as well, so you could fit more cracks on the disk.
So after the crack was done and you sort of did some quality checks and you linked your intro and everything, then you wanted to spread your stuff, of course. That's part of the competition. You wanted to be first and reach out with your crack. I mean, originally that was done by mail and gradually moved into BBSs and online things. I mean, how do you have any comments on that process? And how did it work and how did it affect you?
Okay, so Andreas Greyhawk was sort of my teammate. And every time I cracked something, I called him over, he came. And then I went to the loo, and then he eventually copied it. I was absolutely not aware of it. He was such a bastard spreading my stuff. I only cracked for myself, or it would risk being illegal.
True words from a lawyer.
I can only tell the stories from back then, because I made a big interview with the old members of Genesis Project back in the 90s, and I know the story behind how they got on the American boards, because they had a cooperation with Fire Eagle in Holland. And one fun story was that the Goblin of Genesis Project, he lived in Switzerland. He had no... Switzerland is not the place where you release games first in Europe. It's UK or US. But he got a modem from Antichrist, the founder of Genesis Project. He sent it to Switzerland and got online with the modem and was first. He was one of the best spreaders and crackers and spreaders from 1989, I think, and 1990. Even if he was placed in Switzerland. Before that, it was all mail.
So, I mean, from what you remember back then, those days, who would you say was sort of the best or the most skillful crack, or somebody you really respect? Is it yourself, or, I mean, do you have other idols?
I would say the Mr. Sata was the greatest cracker of them all, because... he was among the first one, the biggest name, got the biggest spread of his stuff worldwide. And, I mean, he was an inspiration, a source of inspiration of most of the teams. And even today, it's when we meet him, we are like awestruck. So it's... there was several others, of course, but he was like the first big name.
Okay, honestly, when I joined the scene, when I bought my C64, the WASP guys, Scanian, cracking group, talented bunch of people, they were the ones that made me eventually want to buy my 64, because I was playing games with a friend and I saw the intros, and my ambition was always to do what they did, add the intro in front of it and the fame that would potentially come out of that. So Ivanhoe is probably one of my first idols. I was not in the circles what I would receive, Sultan stuff. That came only later, but Sultan was also a great inspiration. If I would rank a number of crackers that are really good, Antitrack, even if he's not a person I would like to socialize with a lot, he's very, very good as a cracker. And a few of the Ikari guys were also exceptionally talented. Most other Swedish groups were shit, but...
Penis envy. I don't remember all the names back then, but there was a lot of really good crackers. I mean, I got to know the guys in early Triad, and I mean, Mr. Zeta was the top one, but he was later joined by 3D and like Janitor and people like that. They were really good.
All right. So, I mean, obviously, the people who develop games and code games and so on, and the cracking scene has gone hand in hand, and there has been sort of co-relationships and developments so would you like to say something about that? To what extent has the game development and the cracking scene been separate, or to what extent has it sort of collaborated or fought against each other, or how has that also affected the climate within the scene?
Okay, so I think this is a valid point, because if you look at the scene in different countries, you could see a clear correlation between lack of valid software houses and strong scene. So if you look at Sweden, in the 80s, we didn't have any software houses in Sweden. So if you wanted to become something... Greevy Graphics, fair enough. Very, very small little thing in Lund, but they did great things. Blood and Guts is amazing. But apart from that, we didn't have any strong software development scene here in Sweden. So if somebody had the skill set to do stuff on the computer scene was where we took our pride and where we invested our work. So, whereas if you look at in the UK, you had a number of suppliers, but there are really like 5-10 really fair sceners in the UK, because all of them were sucked up by the software industry. So they were in the game development kind of cycle. It's only, could I say that Digital Illusion is probably the best example of when Sweden turned from a hacking only kind of community to a software development kind of community. So Paradox and all the others, they came after, but Silence are the guys that eventually turn Sweden into a software development kind of environment, and we didn't have that before.
Again, this evolution thing, one thing leads to another, and this cracking demo scene evolved. Eventually the people who made this stuff became game developers themselves. And we have a huge list of this today. Great game developers that started off as crackers, demo makers, etc., etc. And it's no exception. Half of the Sensor Design team, or I could almost say whole, still works in the game industry. And it was born from that. So we can thank the cracking scene, how the evolution went. Our interest just gained momentum. And in the end, this game sucks. We can do it much better. And yes, and then we became the game developers.
But that is in turn of sort of how talent developed and sort of a lot of talented people who work in the game industry or in software development industry today has roots in the wares, the cracking and the demo scene. But if you look at sort of the co-evolution, sometimes the argument was that copying is killing the industry and don't copy that floppy and all these sort of taglines about sort of non-piracy. At the same time, you could argue that, just as Bacchus mentioned, that he saw these copied games at his friends, and that made him want to buy a Commodore 64 and get one himself. So, in some extent, the market grew significantly as a consequence of accessibility to copied games, which of course also made it possible for the more legitimate market to grow as well. So, do you have any comments or thoughts about that?
Me back again here. We see a trend now where the spreading the downloaded users is the most important, not the payer. The payers comes with the amount. Let's say Candy Crush, for instance. You can download the game for free. It's for free. We see more and more this of a trend today that it is spread to get a great foundation of users to play your stuff. And once they get frustrated, believe me, even me will start to pay money for these games. And that's how the game industry have survived these copyright issues. So it's not an issue anymore. They just evolved to this natural process, as I would say.
Yeah, well, you echoed my own view that the initial game producer lost a bit of money, potential sales, because people were playing or playing the cracked version of the game. But you gained so many new users. So we grew the computer base so that the game developers a few years later could sell it to a population that was 10 times bigger. If I wouldn't have played Blue Max at my friend Mats's house, I probably wouldn't have bought that C64, because that was the thing that won me over. And I've spent tens of thousands of Swedish crowns or even euros on computer stuff now. So that crack of Blue Max costed the producer of Blue Max potentially a few pennies. But I think I paid back to the industry times 100 or times 1,000. The only exception is GP cracking Rubicon, of course, which is a shitty act. The rest of the cracking scene has been justified, but that has not been justified.
Yeah, the amount of computers in Swedish homes back in the 80s grew every year by, I mean, everybody had a computer finally when they actually got hands on new games. And then they started to buying games as well, so it really grew the computer market a lot.
Talking about Rubicon, it's an important story to tell, because it's in the middle of the fusion between crackers and the game industry. It was made by members of Fairlight.
50%
here. And they wanted a good copy protection, so they asked one of the best crackers, which of course was in Genesis Project, Snacky, to make this protection. And it's not... I think they cracked it last year or something. It took a couple of years to crack that protection. The problem was that it wasn't protected when Genesis Project had it. And of course, we wanted to race to the top back then. So another guy in Genesis Project got the original without the protection and released it. It was not Snacky. It was someone else. And I know the name, but you don't.
Let me say, that was a backstabbing beyond belief. However, Fairlight cracking the Silence version of Pinball Dreams, that's totally different. That was so justified. That was a fair race to the top. That's not backstabbing.
The fun story on Pinball Dreams is that the Silent guys wrote a very, very angry letter about it. And it looked exactly like the letter that Bill Gates wrote to the community when people started copying BASIC back in the, like, 70s. And the reply from Strider was just excellent, I think, because, I mean, if you release a game, the scene will crack it. It doesn't matter which one, whoever wrote it, so.
And GP made a great thing with Pinball Dreams, because we wanted to make up for years of cracking, so I think it was on Datastorm 3 years ago or 2 years ago, GP handed out, I think it was 60 copies of Pinball Dreams original to people on the party. So should have been you.
No, okay.
No comment.
So I mean, the cracking scene as we sort of think of it was somehow established, I would say, in the 1980s as a consequence of all the home computers like the Commodore 64 and others. And out of that, at some point, sort of the demo scene grew out as sort of a separate entity. I mean, when would you say that the cracking scene and the demo scene, that sort of at what times were they firmly established as subcultures, or sort of what kind of term you would use? Was there something special sort of activity or something that you can trace back to sort of try to understand the developments?
I saw some early crack intros from 82 or even before that on the Apple II. So it might not have been the C64 that spawned the intro idea. But I have preserved thousands of discs and added them to CSDB, and it was my university course to the old age before I was active. 84, 85, maybe, something like that. The people spread intros without any game on it.
And when did it sort of make separate ways with the demo scene? When with the demo scene sort of evolve in another direction, and why?
Well, first of all, it's everything is gradual, so you need to go over a certain threshold, and then we need to discuss what is the threshold. Fairlight has always been a group that has both demo coders and so demo production and also cracking. It's gone hand in hand. We tend to say that we are stronger. Built stronger to last longer is the tagline here. It's actually rapping on lorries. That was I nicked that from there. So it's somebody doing the cover for lorries that has that as a tagline. I think it's a gradual evolution over time, and there is no particular point unless you find a particular demo that clearly distinguishes itself. There has always been people coding, trying to prove that they can do it, not for making something that sits in front of a game. I also agree that I've read a number of threads on the internet on that Apple II is probably the first scene where cracking is sort of happening. But I think the C64 is still the first scene that kind of took it. It took quantum leaps when we started doing it on the C64. And demo scene has always sort of, if it's an intro scene or if it's a separate thing, but groups, a number of groups are pure cracker groups and a number of groups are pure demo groups. We're sort of hanging out in the same context, and a number of people are doing both. Some of them would even have multiple handles. One would be a legit handle that they would only use for their demo stuff, and then they would have another one for their cracking stuff. But I still think it's hand in hand, and for me it's no point in sort of defining when they split up, because they haven't.
I think the very few early demos that were really good I saw were the ones coming out of CompuServe in the UK. Stout and Tim and people like that. And that was, starting other people to do other than pure intros for cracks. And then 1001 Crew and early people like that really took the next step with opening the sideboard, and then people really started to do new demo effects on the C64. I think that around 85, I would say, things really got started big.
If we compare the cracking scene at those days, sort of 1980s, 1990s to some extent, with what's happening today, with the cracking and releasing of sort of copied games in various formats, what are the differences and why?
For me, the biggest thing that changed is the flattening of the pyramid. The time from the top of the pyramid to the bottom of the pyramid. Back in the days when we had mail as mail distribution form, it took months before the average kid on the schoolyard would have access to the new game. So they would have months to sell the game before there was a valid competition between having a cracked version and buying the original. Whereas today, where the pyramid is basically totally flat, it takes a day and then it's out on torrents and everything is distributed. And for me, that's a lot more difficult to justify, because there is an ego boast in my kid brother's friend having my crack. That's fine. That's sort of an ego boost. But that does not say that I care too much about all lamers having my game. I prefer to have appreciation from my peers than from everybody else on the schoolyard. So I think for me it's concerning that everything goes so fast and that the average Joe could have it months before it's in the shop. That is seriously harming the business. and the business has realized that. So the business model today totally changed for the moving environment. Now everybody has like a Steam account, so you subscribe to the software and the physical copy has no value. Everything you buy is the code for buying it on Steam. So it's just another method. So getting a case is just another method to get it on Steam. So I think the business has adopted well to the environment where you cannot tie something to the physical copy.
But it also relies on constant internet access. Any other takes on that?
I can only answer for the live C64 cracking scene. So
yeah, but I mean, Sensor, for instance. I mean, you have been releasing things on the console scene as well. I mean, so I mean, how does it differ with sort of different formats with the computers and consoles and sort of other areas?
Console scene started to grow about 1993 with the Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo. SNES, well, and back then the internet just started to kick off, Algonet, etc. So the spreading of these larger files was much more easier. There was more different base from BBSs turned over to the ERC channels, all other more greater storage capacities and stuff like that, where you could download and get your stuff from. The take on it, it was for us a natural thing because you bought a cartridge. You had it in your hand. It wasn't just to copy it. Was it China or somewhere they made an add-on cartridge where you could save just... Hong Kong based companies made these copiators. And that made it possible for us to actually suck down the data, store it somewhere, load it to a floppy and etc. But more and more, as they mentioned, the internet came in. So that was a challenge for the console era between the early 90s and the mid 90s. I would say the cracking scene grew a lot. And that also caused a lot of interest in the consoles as well. Because I remember that is also the era we started to make computer games. We, for instance, did Elite Serien Hockey for Sega Genesis. And back then in Sweden, a top-sold game, sold like 20,000 copies. Today, a top sales games, it sells so much you can't even count. There is probably not even enough people in Sweden because they buy in software, so it's difficult to count. You count by the download numbers. And you could see from year to year how much this grew. It was amazing. And how much money was involved into this as well. So yes, there was a very big interest in console, and that would, for us, was the step into the game business, because all of a sudden we knew how to code these machines. We knew most of it. And for the joke's sake, we contacted Electronic Arts. Hey, we can code something. You want to see a demo? And from there on it went. And they actually knew about our cracks. But they weren't angry.
But that kind of console scene also led to a whole new scene, like hardware cracking, where you actually try to crack the protection on things like the PlayStation 3 and Xbox and things like that, which gave birth to like real hardware hackers actually breaking into the machine, because even if you broke the copy protection of the software itself, you could not run it. So people now that are hardware hackers try to break all those old machines like Nintendo, 3DSs, things like that, so you can actually play all the games that you would like on it.
I guess, David, this is basically your comment, but today, one of the things that happened on the C64 scene today is that new released games are not always published on CSDB. So CSDB is sort of the track of everything that's released. But out of courtesy for the people doing the game, there are no download links. So, which is sort of a new thing. I mean, if you want to brag and there is the pissing contest of being first and shortest and what have you not, the links are still not shared because we would like people to actually buy the original. We want to ensure that the little industry that's still left has the opportunity of selling their stuff. So there is a bigger understanding from the scene that we need to tread carefully not to kill the few ones still wanting to invest money in it.
But then you're mentioning the today's C64 scene. I would say that sort of another difference in talking broadly about sort of the PC scene and games and so on is that, I mean, the significance of the intros has diminished. I mean, on the Commodore 64 and the Amiga, I mean, you had sort of very strong presence of the intros. And you said, Bacchus, that, I mean, you were thrilled of seeing these intros in front of the games that were also interesting, of course. But, I mean, in today's releases, in different formats and at different platforms, I mean, you barely see any intros. It's just sort of text files, very sort of... it's only about perhaps the release group, but not about the individuals. For various reasons, but I mean, what happened to the intros and why?
I think they moved over to key generators for a while, where they showed off some graphics and music, and nowadays it's about how the file name of your torrent, and you add your name in the end, and that's it. It's really boring, actually.
Do you have any reflections on the role of money in the scene, especially within cracking at the time? Did it? Did you crack for money? Do you know other people who did it? Did you? How did your groups manage? Because sometimes you needed to buy originals. Was it just your own private pocket money? Did you have more organized ways of raising money for the costs that you had to run your group? There were others perhaps within the scene who actually sold pirated copies, making a profit, which is sort of probably both illegal and immoral, and so on. Any takes on that?
From Genesis Project's point of view, there was no money-making in the cracking scene. When I read the old letters and stuff, I have the archive for the group, there is no money involved in it. It's just, like Bob said, it's a race to the top. You want to be a name, you want to be on the top. And you actually look down on people like, we just talked about the Swedish famous Jan. Everyone knows the phone number if you have own a C64. Call John for more games. You looked down on that because it was not.
Yeah, Fairlight was the same, and I can only talk for the C64 section. I think the PC is something I want to kind of not look into for that perspective. But first of all, we got most of the originals without paying anything for anything, which means that there is no need for raising money to actually pay for it. And I worked for one of the computer stores in Eslöv, so I actually sold the games to Jan that eventually Xack would crack for Jan, so he could sell it. First Love Hackers, yeah, very elite. Knatter and a few of the other guys were really skilled, so I'm not saying anything. But so they had somebody paying for the original, and they cracked a version that they would spread, but he would get the version without the intro, and then he would sell it in one of the... Datamagasin, yeah. You could have on Yellow Pages and all of that. So, but again, for us, it was never about the money, and I'm pretty sure that if I had known that some of my members would have been selling games, they would have been fired instantly. That's not the moral standard that we apply. That's not what we did it. So if somebody would use our work for their personal gain, fuck them and they're out. They could.
I mean, the expensive part was sending these cracks to other people, like for the swappers. So there were different methods for doing this. It was like taping stamps, so you can actually remove the stamp and send it and use them again. And also, you can do like I did for some time, because I collected stamps for a while. I used my old stamp collection.
When you were really low on money.
Well, I've done, again, I'm a lawyer, so I try to apply a higher moral. So I needed to be a bit more creative, but I did the gluing on and everything. There was spray glue, that was really excellent. But Swedish Post System, they had a folder showing the new stamps that would come up for this year. They were excellent. I took all of them. So I used stuff printed by the post office making commercials for the upcoming stamps. They were really like 50 sec that you can send big packages abroad. They were really, really excellent. But you can see the stamp, it was cut in square, and so you'll see the black edges. I just cut them in. I wouldn't bother doing this little like curly thing. That's fuck up.
And something really expensive that really costed money was calling US, of course, to get your cracks over there. And there was no money involved there either, because we had freakers with AT&T cards and stuff like that. So, well, it doesn't cost us anything, but someone else back in the days, yeah. But it feels like the AT&T rush were it was over in the middle of the 90s for the C64 scene, at least. They busted a lot of people there.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on issues, and I mean, Backus just mentioned, I mean, very, very high morals on sort of selling cracked game for your personal gain. So, I mean, there are strong values involved there, whereas abusing the telephone network in different ways for or the postal system, I mean, then you apply sort of different kinds of morals. Obviously, I mean, did you sort of consciously reflect on this at the time, or you sort of did what felt good, or?
That's the little anarchist communist in me wanting to fuck up the big corporations.
Kill a commie for your mommy.
But obviously, I mean, as we moved on from disk swapping in envelopes using the postal system and glued stamps and so on onto BBSs, which of course took over to a large degree. I mean, we had other challenges with the Baron, for instance, mentioned already, with finding ways of calling for free. This was pre-internet. So, I mean, how did you do that, and how did you manage and everything around that?
What did you say?
I said, how did you manage to cope with the costs around calling around the world for free in competing with others? And obviously, you couldn't just pay the bills with the ordinary price tags. I mean, there were freakers, there were different methods for sort of being able to call around the world for free. And I mean, how did all that work out?
I took money from my own pockets. I was working in those days. I made a lot of money selling photos all over the world and working computers, helping other people. I get some paid things. So I paid for everything. I never did this for money. Never, never, ever. But I was not interested in game cracks. It just flowed away inside my BBS. I was more interested in desktop publishing, expensive programs, Adobe fonts, and a lot of money, just because I can and I could, and I used them. Later, when I had more money, I bought the original. But never, never, never made it for money. No way, no way. And I also wanted to be anonymous in those days. I didn't want to be seen. But it's all changed now, I think.
Yeah. So my question was perhaps more, I mean, not necessarily you individually, but I mean, as scene groups and as the scene as a whole, I mean, how did it manage to keep around paying those phone bills when you had to phone all around the world? I mean, how did freaking work and sort of who did that and how did everything get organized and work out? And how did you cope with sort of police or other people tracking you?
I mean, there was all kinds of methods for calling for free. One was, for example, using relays. Like, if you found a big company, you can just forward this number to another number. And that would cost them a lot of money, of course. But they were big corporations. Nobody cared about that. And the same goes for credit cards that people used to use AT&T, like free calls. It was the same thing. I mean, somewhere deep inside, you know someone paid for it, but I mean, I got free calls.
From my personal phone, I had no method whatsoever. I worked for Datamine saying to basically finance my addiction of computer stuff. So that sort of financed my 6,000-7,000 SEK. A lot of money for a student. It's still a lot of money. So that was my only trick. And then I had this thing where you can use a DTMF unit and then call for free from a phone booth in Sweden, which is a shitty cold country. So if I have physical issues with my finger, it's probably due to me calling for free from a stupid phone booth.
Yes, we also used these cards. And the PBXs and these relay techniques that you just put the tone. You had a tone sequence, and you automatically DTMF stuff. And yeah,
but in the bottom line, or are you referring to blue boxing?
Yeah, it's blue boxing probably. I don't even remember anymore. It was so long time ago. But we did all that, and in the bottom line, it was we didn't need to pay for anything, but we didn't got any money either. So everything was for free. It was in the way we could move around, do whatever we wanted, and it was for our main purpose to gain everyone else's attention, win the race to first release, and perhaps a small sighted view of the world. But it worked for us as a team. Everybody had a common goal. No one really thought of making profits of them all. I mean, most of us, when going to school, some of us had some side jobs, so we could afford to buy the hardware, the extra, or run a BBS, etc., etc. So, and most of us actually come from normal families. None of us was in a shitty situation, as far as I can see. Everybody lived in houses or good apartments, good stable relationships with their parents. There was no... I couldn't see really that there was absolute mayhem somewhere. Of course, it did exist, but not in our team. And the need for earning money. I mean, I think we had the comfort. Is it trygghet? Comfort. The comfort was there, so there was no point of gaining money or anything. I think you need to remove the area of comfort in order to have other interest grown as gaining money. And that's what we can see of today, perhaps. The criminality of finance, fraud, etc., etc. is gaining momentum.
Many of the groups you were active in were sort of active internationally and not just locally in your neighborhood or your city where you lived and so on. But I mean, at the time, most of you were teenagers. So I mean, how did you manage to sort of get well-functioning international organizations where you sort of communicated on a very sort of tight basis and formed teams that worked very well together on using sort of all those constraints when you never had the time to meet or and so on? How did it work out?
First of all, we went to parties a few times. So most of the people, at least, we've met a few times. So, I mean, and then if you have a face, it's a lot easier to manage people when you have a face. But it's a highly valid question. I mean, the team I'm running today, they sit in the same office and they are like herding cats, whereas I could manage a full team being in my early 20s in five continents. No, we didn't have any in Antarctica. But anyway, but I mean, over multiple time zones in multiple countries and post was basically the only thing you could use. I guess a number of you have bought this Generation 64, so you've seen my sort of harsh member send-outs. So that's one way to communicate so that everyone had like a level playing field. And then... an occasional phone call every now and then just to see where we are and working. Because the target that everybody was sort of working against was sort of well-defined. We are going to kick ass. And we do it by getting the games we can, getting them out, doing the demos we can, get them out. It's a very, very clear objective. And everybody's role was to participate as greatly as they could. And they did. And my role was only to manage herding the cats. And I also tried to do a bit more, walking that extra mile, pushing myself and to be sort of an inspiration, being the more active cracker. It's very difficult if you are a lazy cracker, being a lazy cracker, if your manager is an active cracker. You can't say it takes a lot of time because that guy cannot be fooled. He's doing it himself and he's walking that extra mile every day for the group. So... I think that's sort of it. Walk the extra mile, and that was motivational management for me. And I still can't understand how you could actually manage groups over multiple continents by mail. But when you can't do it in the office today, when you have like 25 years experience doing it, it's one of those things with idiot-proof stuff. They keep inventing new, more innovative idiots.
I have a similar story. We wanted to make games with a team where money was involved. Not everybody was interested. We were absent from the scene like 18 years or so. We did well, but not as a team anymore. We were scattered all over. But one day, when we decided to reform Sensor Design again and do a comeback, it didn't take more than 2 days to assemble most of the people back on track. Now, that's the difference between company, money-orientated stuff and ideological hobby stuff. I mean, it gives me goosebumps when I compare this stuff. It is so amazing to see the core interest of people actually is not perhaps earning money and get the work done or whatever game you want to do. It is actually to do what you want to do. It is this scene stuff, the Commodore 64, if it is cracking or if it is demo making, etc., that really inspires you. As I was grown up, I was so inspired by other demo creators that it absolutely struck me. I mean, it needed to get a similar feeling. You have to drive a Ferrari or something to get this impact or... emotional impact. Not many things in life gives you this impact, if you get a child, of course, and stuff like that. But this inspirational creativity impact, it just goes on and on. And it's so funny to see that so many people around you that you have known for 20 years shares exactly the same mentality, and they were there. And all of a sudden, within 3 months, we went to X from an 18 years absence and competed. That is a true commitment as a senior.
Okay. Going back a little bit to sort of the competition at the time between the different groups, of course you competed in sort of trying to get the originals early, to crack them, having good quality, release them, and so on. But I mean... how did it work out in other ways? Did you sort of share tools with each other, or was the competition in sort of creating the best cracking tools, and then possibly you sort of secretly got some of them? Did you reverse engineer each other's loaders? Things like that, sort of competition on that level between the different teams?
Yes, yes, and yes to your three questions, I think. But... So you did your own tools, you kept them very secret, or you spread them. And that's also one of the ethics. If you're giving something in trust, it's for you. You don't spread it. So to this day, I haven't spread the EBC, the Equal Byte Compressor that I got from Triangle, because I was entrusted with it. I don't spread it to anyone, right? But I was happy to pick up. I was happy to pick up Patrick's stuff, the transfers he did. So yes, there was a competition of having the best tool, because if the competition was also making stuff fast and also short, you needed good transfer to make the for the speed. You need good crunchers for the size. So having better tool than the other guy gave you a head start. And of course, so. The race for the top tools is an essential piece, and they were spread in very much smaller circle than the rest of the stuff. But and racing for the top being the challenge, I still, one of the things, because I haven't experienced your experience, how does it feel to race for the top and then realize that you are Sensor and Genesis Project? Isn't that shit? I can at least wake up really realizing I'm Fairlight, so I'm on the good side. But how does it feel to wake up thinking, oh dear, I'm Genesis?
Well, before Fairlight was born, we had Genesis in 85 or 86.
That was a gay party.
I'm very proud to be part of Genesis today. We restarted, rebooted in 2009. And Six organized the cracking scene and the demo part from the beginning. He took all the old members that never left, put them together with new talents, and we aimed to the. That's exactly what Bob said. We aimed for the top directly with the cracking charts. We wanted to be number one, and we couldn't have a lukewarm start. So, and we did that. We released most cracks than anyone else in 2010 or 12 or whatever it was. And we spawned, with that restart in 2009, we spawned a lot of old groups seeing what we did, and they came back. And now even Fairlight released cracks again on the C64. And we have Atlantis and Fantastic Four cracking crew, and everyone came back when we spawn, look what we can do. We can push out 32 cracks in 1 year compared to 2000 when it was 5 cracks or something, and it was only a fight between Triad and Onslaught on the C64. So I'm proud every day I wake up to renew the scene and keep the tradition living.
And of course, we're good friends off the pitch.
I know where you live too.
But when we are on the pitch, we are fierce enemies. And if we would be friends in the competition, it's like two boxers being friends. You cannot fight in the ring if you're friend with the other guy. You need to put that aside, and you fiercely fight one another, and then you go off, and then you hug and have a beer. So, and I'm really, really proud to take you on, not every day, but most of the days of the week, and I appreciate the fact that you're actually doing shit, and I hate your gut the few times where you actually beat us.
One thing that I mean hasn't been very prominent and so on has been people taking credit for other people's work. I mean, people using hex editors to sort of do some simple editing to say I did this, even though they did not. But I mean, to some extent, I mean, has that happened also within more established teams, that you sort of copied part of somebody else's code, you disassembled it and you recoded it, and then you took credit as if it was your own? I mean, has that kind of things happened, or has there been sort of a moral standard within the scene that, I mean, you only take credit for your own work?
I would say this is actually happening in the demo scene, but not in that way. It is more of an evolution. Look, I could do two more dots than you. If you look, scan these codes, they are identical, almost. And of course, you could accuse one another, but it perhaps are not so many ways to do it differently in order to get that speed code. So yes, you could accuse every second demo coder of copying each other's code in that case, even though it's not intentionally, unless they want to beat the other one with whatever it is. So it's not really noticed as that such anymore, I would say. It's more of a beating the other one.
I mean, of course, people read each other's code. It's like looking at the website today and reading the CSS and HTML and just copy that. It was like, of course, people did that. They copied the ideas of each other's code. And I mean, the sideboarder thing was like everybody did it after a while because they learned how to do it from the original code. Then they learned how to do it themselves. So, but the interesting things about the tools part that we talked about was that, I mean, every cracking group, of course, kept their tools for themselves. But once a public tool that was released, like more publicly, like the Timing Cruncher and tools like that, everybody started using it until they figured out a way to do it better. Then they kept their tools for themselves, the newer ones.
Yeah.
The only thing today that is like this, every tool is available. The best crunchers and everything is out there. But the loaders are still kept secretly between the groups. If you have a good IFFL loader, you keep it for yourself. But the crunchers and everything else is well known today. But the loaders are still kept in a safe box at home.
Yeah, we have to wrap up now. But thank you so much for your insights in the cracking scene of the early days and beyond to today.
Yes, yes, yes. That was quite a massive set of cracking talk, I must say. We didn't anticipate it to go on for this long, but hey, it's good stuff. I don't know if they're going to announce anything else, but what's going to happen? Oh, okay, here we have Spot. Let's see what he does.
All right, so DJ Opdrock is playing... Japanese ship style music on the outside, and the dinner will be served in something like 10 minutes. So have fun.
Okay, yes, as you heard, there's a DJ on the outside. We don't have a connection from that in here, so I can't stream it. What I will do is I'm gonna stop the actual audio stream right now, or the actual show itself, and I'm going to stop the Facebook stream as well, because that actually needs to be kind of maintained. If you want to keep watching anything from here now until I start the Facebook and YouTube and Twitch stuff again, you can go to sceneside.com/video. Because I'll keep a feed going on our SceneSat server with some background music of some sort and just an ambient pick from here. We're gonna do some tweaking with the camera and things as well. So, but other than that, the live thing on Facebook and other stuff will be available later on. I think that I'll be back around 8 p.m. for Chris Hulsbeck live on stage, an interview held by Mahoney. So we'll start that. But other than that, I'm stopping the music and, stopping this show now and just leave the video floating on sceneside.com/video. And this has been Civoid. This is Datastorm or Datastorm 2017 Summer, live from Gothenburg. See you a bit later.